It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It sounds like something out of science fiction. A scientist discovers a substance strong enough to contain nuclear chemicals and realizes that it's toxic to humans right away when factory workers get chemical burns and breathing problems. But the compound, it ends up in a wide array of consumer products, pots and pans, firefighting foam, furniture, clothing, contact lenses, lipstick, and more. It's the story of PFAS chemicals used in Teflon, carpet treatments, and many other applications, and now a pollution concern in waters around Wisconsin and the country. Jim Boyson of French Island is one of the thousands of Wisconsinites who have dealt with the consequences of PFAS pollution. He talked to WPR earlier this year.
How do you get rid of it? You can't water your lawn because it'll go down through the ground into your well, right back where you got it from. So you're pretty much at the will of the PFAS, actually. Our kids all drank it. Our company all drank it. We used to have parties over here. They all drank it. We've been drinking it that long. I've got thyroid problems, probably from that, because it started since then. That's another reason why we're so enthused about getting this thing taken care of. You just get kind of a guilt feeling knowing that you were feeding poison to your friends and your children. That's the hardest part for me to take.
In her new book, investigative journalist Mariah Blake traces the history of PFAS chemicals and communities dealing with PFAS pollution. The book is called They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals. Rob Ferret talked to her earlier this week.
Mariah, there's been this slow burn of PFAS stories and concerns here in Wisconsin, around the country. What led you into your reporting on this and exploring the origins and evolution of this problem?
Well, my interest in the topic is actually deeply personal. So I first began researching toxic chemicals when I was pregnant with my son back in 2010. I knew that certain chemicals were known to be extremely harmful to developing fetuses. So I took steps to try to remove these chemicals from my home. So I went through my cabinets and got rid of all of my plastic food containers and dishes. I researched what was in the water in my hometown, which is Washington, D.C., and I discovered that there were traces of toxic chemicals in the drinking water there. Eventually, I stumbled upon a complaint for a lawsuit that was filed by a group of West Virginia residents. It involved a chemical, a forever chemical known as PFOA, that is used to make Teflon, and that was in the drinking water of this community in West Virginia. And as I dug into the court record, it became clear to me that this chemical was extremely toxic, that it was in the blood of virtually every person on the planet, and that it didn't break down, but that industry had withheld this information.
I want to take things back to the origin. If you had asked me last week, before I read your book, where was PFAS first used, I would have said consumer products, Teflon, maybe fire extinguisher foam. I don't know. No, it turns out the Manhattan Project, right? Research on developing atomic weapons. How did that lead to the rise of the use of these chemicals?
That's a really good question. And this was one of the things I was most astonished to discover in the course of my research. And that is that forever chemicals, or PFAS, were first developed by the U.S. government as part of the top secret Manhattan Project. As you said, they were needed for uranium enrichment because uranium enrichment involved this substance that was so caustic that would burn through everything, including stainless steel. So they needed substances that could withstand this highly caustic chemical that was used in uranium manufacturing, and Manhattan Project scientists ultimately determined that the only substances that could do this were substances that brought together fluorine and carbon, which together form the strongest bond in chemistry. So they launched this elaborate program involving the top chemists in laboratories all across the country to develop what were then known as fluorocarbons, but what are now known as PFAS. And they began mass producing them in collaboration with DuPont at a factory in New Jersey. It was clear from the outset that these were dangerous chemicals. So At the plants where they were manufacturing them, fires and explosions were commonplace. Workers were constantly being hospitalized with chemical burns and breathing problems or worse. But it wasn't just the workers who were affected. Farmers downwind of these plants quickly began to complain that their peach crops were burning up, that their cows were so crippled they couldn't stand. They had to graze by crawling on their bellies. And in some cases, farm workers who ate the produce they picked also fell ill.
Sometimes I think people think, okay, we used this chemical for decades, a long time, and didn't know, right? It only slowly emerged that this was a problem. What you're saying there, though, is early days, literally some the first years of use of this, we were seeing environmental and health impacts.
Yes. Well, so the farmers' complaints alarmed Manhattan Project officials. So they actually began researching the health effects of these chemicals in the 1940s. As part of this broader program to research the health effects of special Manhattan Project materials, including uranium and plutonium. And as early as 1947, Manhattan Project scientists had determined that these chemicals were toxic and that they were accumulating in human blood. This is one of the things that makes these chemicals so dangerous. As your listeners probably know, they stay in the body for many years. So government scientists had an indication that this was the case as early as 1947. But even more concerning, by the 1970s, scientists who were working with this program, which continued after the war under the auspices of the Atomic Energy Commission, had discovered that these chemicals were accumulating in the blood of people all across the country, including in places where there was no known source of contamination. And that discovery is what led to concern within industry about these chemicals.
A little detour here is something I think we should point out. Sometimes when we know there's something that can be toxic, lead, for example, it might exist independently in the environment. When we're talking about PFAS chemicals, this is a category of what? Human-made chemicals, right? We're not going to run into this in nature.
They are almost exclusively man-made. So there is one type of fluorocarbon that exists naturally in nature, but the majority of the 9,000 PFAS that are in circulation today are man-made. They come from laboratories. They do not exist naturally.
All right, now take us from the Manhattan Project to this explosion in the number of products being made with various members of this long list of PFAS chemicals. How did we get from nuclear weapons research to this ubiquitous, a super common use of these chemicals?
That's a very good question. So after the war, a company called 3M, which is based in Minneapolis, acquired patents for technology to produce PFAS and also hired Manhattan Project chemists to help turn them into products that could be sold to manufacturers or marketed to the general public. And this led to innovations like ScotchGard, the fabric protector, an additive that 3M created made it possible to produce Teflon. And eventually these chemicals found their way into thousands of everyday products. Some examples include contact lenses, baby clothes, diapers, dental floss, kitty litter, furniture, carpeting. The list is basically endless. So these exotic chemicals that were developed for the purpose of enriching nuclear fuels eventually became ubiquitous in our homes and lives.
We're talking to investigative journalist Mariah Blake about her new book. It's called They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals, talking about the PFAS category of chemicals. You've heard about them in the news here in Wisconsin. Mariah, you look at a couple particular case studies. One, kind of the first big public, I think, exposure to PFAS or to information about it in West Virginia. And then Hoosick Falls, New York. Can you take us in? Parkersburg was early. I don't think people paid as much attention to it. This Hoosick Falls story, though, you really focus on a lot of the people at the center of it. Why was PFAS there? What did you learn from the people you talked to?
Well, so there is a factory in Hoosic Falls that makes Teflon-coated fabric. Now, at the point the contamination was discovered there, there were only a few communities anywhere in the country that knew that their drinking water was polluted with this class of chemicals, although the EPA had been put on notice as early as 2001 that these chemicals were ubiquitous in the environment. But really, most places were not aware. There were very few communities that were aware that their drinking water was polluted. In the case of Hoosic Falls, there was this unassuming insurance underwriter named Michael Hickey, who began to suspect that his drinking water was polluted after losing several friends and relatives to cancer. And his father had actually worked at the local factory that made Teflon-coated fabric and had died of kidney cancer. So at some point, Michael sat down and Googled Teflon and cancer and called up this massive health study that had been conducted in West Virginia, and it had linked PFAS to kidney cancer. Now, that factory happened to be right next to the wells that supplied the community's drinking water. And so he began pressing the mayor to test the drinking water for these chemicals and did not succeed. And so he tested the water himself and discovered astronomical levels of PFAS, so levels that are 100 times the EPA's current safety standard. He was spearheading this fight against several giant multinational corporations and government agencies to get his community clean drinking water. And other people had joined him in this fight, and they were a lot like him in that they were, you know, they were people who'd never taken much of an interest in politics, had spent their lives believing there were systems in place to protect them. And now that trust had been utterly crushed. But rather than being resigned, they fought like hell to protect their community. So as a result of, largely as a result of these citizen activists, there's been a huge amount of state-level legislation on PFAS. There are currently 30 states have passed more than 155 laws, including, I believe it's 16 full or partial bans on the entire class of chemicals in consumer products. This is not the way we regulate chemicals in this country. We normally regulate them one by one. And there's also been, you know, there's a huge number of lawsuits that have been filed, including several in the state of Wisconsin, one by the state itself and several by municipalities. You have huge shifts happening in the market. Huge swaths of the economy are voluntarily migrating away from PFAS. And in fact, 3M, which is the world's largest manufacturer of these chemicals, has announced that it will quit producing them by the end of this year.
That wasn't always the industry response. One of the side threads, I think you could say, in the book is how the industry reacted to these findings about PFAS in communities. And you compare it and see a lot of overlap with, for example, cigarette companies and how they knew their products were dangerous and how they approached that publicly.
So manufacturers, particularly DuPont and 3M, the two main manufacturers of these chemicals, have known since the 1960s that they were toxic. They knew as early as the 1970s that they were accumulating in the blood of people all across the country. And they eventually began looking at blood of people all around the world. So 3M tested thousands of samples from people in countries all across the globe, including remote rural China, and they looked at archived medical studies dating back to the 1930s and 40s. The only blood they could find that didn't contain these chemicals was collected from Korean war vets before 1952. So basically, before these chemicals went into mass production. Now, this set off some alarm inside industry, understandably, and they started intensively researching these chemicals. And they DuPont and 3M specifically, they quickly discovered that PFAS did not break down in the environment, that they were extremely damaging to lab animals. So in one case, they tested a certain PFAS on monkeys. The study had to be aborted because all of the monkeys died. These companies also used their own employees as lab rats. So they started testing the health effects of these chemicals on their employees and were able to establish by the 1980s that they were associated with certain kinds of cancer, with organ damage, with suppressed immunity, with reduced testosterone. But most alarmingly, they were found to be associated with birth defects. So in the 1980s, after a study by 3M had found that rats exposed in utero to a certain PFAS developed birth defects, specifically deformities of the eye, DuPont launched what it called a pregnancy outcome study. And as part of this program, it monitored the pregnancies of workers in its Teflon division. And as it turned out, 2 of 7 pregnant women who gave birth during the course of the study gave birth to children with facial deformities very similar to those found in the eyes of rats. But rather than inform regulators or the public or its own workers, DuPont simply canceled the study.
Mariah, as we wrap up, we've mentioned this is an issue here in Wisconsin, places like French Island in the western part of the state, Marinette Peshtigo in northeastern Wisconsin. Based on what you've seen from communities that responded and took action, if people are out there listening saying, yes, this is a problem, I'm worried about this in my community, what would you suggest to them on starting to push back and dig into this issue?
Well, you know, the people that I've been following, they did whatever they could think of. So they spoke out in the media, they organized protests, they organized boycotts, they filed lawsuits, they demanded change from legislators, and they have made a remarkable difference. You know, in the case of Minnesota, there was a young woman named Amara Strande who began testifying before the state legislature as it was considering a bill to ban the entire class of chemicals. She had been diagnosed with cancer at age 15, and she lived on a plume that was a groundwater plume that had been contaminated by 3M, and you know, she died shortly before her 21st birthday. But 3 weeks later, the legislature passed the most aggressive PFAS legislation in the country. And there are stories like that, that are happening everywhere. So, individuals can really make a difference, especially on the state level. And I would just encourage, you know, people in Wisconsin who are concerned about this issue, to act. To encourage the state to be more aggressive in regulating these chemicals. Because so far, the state has not acted as aggressively as some other states.
Mariah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mariah Blake is the author of They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals.